Caromcast. It is May 17th, 2011. We are broadcasting from our beautiful studios in Hollywood, California. My name is Karam, and I have my co-host, Amy Lynn Chadwick.
Hello, happy full moon.
And our special guest, now a recurring feature of the Karamcast, the one and only Truffle Jones.
Hello, thank you for having me back.
Oh, well, I have to tell you that you're back by special request. We got an email from maybe Norway, and someone said that they really enjoyed hearing Truffle Jones on the podcast, and they wanted to have him return.
Yeah.
Outstanding. That goes to my cousin who's in the Navy station in Norway. That $20 is coming your way.
Okay, then. So the craziest part of all of this is that the last time we spoke, we were getting a little bit concerned about the situation in Egypt.
Yes.
Since then, there have been tsunamis, earthquakes, nuclear meltdowns,
floods,
Libyan and Syrian civil war, the death of bin Laden, the royal wedding, a Canadian election, tornadoes in the southern states, 15-foot floods coursing their way through Louisiana, levees being broken, military showing up at small communities and saying, hi, you've got a couple of hours to get everything you own and get out of here.
Mothers injecting Botox into their children.
Their 8-year-old children, mm-hmm. That's right. We went to the NAB show in Las Vegas.
Yes.
And on a lighter and happier, brighter note, we've had personally, what, 3 movie premieres? Amy, you were in Disney's Prom.
I was.
Got to go see that. And
that was exciting.
The film that I did a couple of years ago in Hawaii called One Kind Day finally surfaced and showed up at the Asian International Film Festival. We got to see that at the DGA. So there was all sorts of red carpeting going on. And the third one, I guess, is Tulip Pink, which was a short film that I did at UCLA. But the exciting part was that this little one-minute thing that we labored over for about a year showed up at the Newport Beach Film Festival. And that was really exciting. Although we didn't go because it was really far away and it was hot that day.
And there was a lot of traffic.
There was a lot of traffic. So it would have been like 4 hours of travel for a 1-minute short.
And I got a boil on my back and that popped.
Wow.
Did that not also play in Paris?
It played in Paris that same week.
That's exciting.
And I did ask you, Truffle, if you wanted to get on a jet and head off to Paris for a 1-minute premiere.
And I would have, unfortunately, had commitments in Las Vegas.
You were in Las Vegas.
And I was using the jet to go to New York.
Right, right. So I don't even know that we can cover all of those things, nor do I think we need to after all the pundits have had their way with it. I mean, is there anything of that you want to discuss?
No, only that you forgot one small, very small tidbit, which the death of an imposing, notorious...
No, I mentioned that.
Did you?
Yeah, I mentioned
we'll
that.
We'll just edit this all out then.
You mean Obi-Wan Kenobi being killed by Darth Vader?
Yes.
That happened. But I do have to comment that the thing that happened in Japan, that earthquake, was absolutely the most mind-boggling thing. I mean, Amy, you saw it first as far as me hearing about it. You were watching the news.
I was making cookies, and I was watching the news because something was going on with Charlie Sheen, and I just wanted to see what it was. He was getting raided.
Right. We were in the Charlie Sheen paradigm at that point.
And it was good that I never had to see another Charlie Sheen thing again, but I was horrified watching this all go down live in front of me.
Right, we saw that live, and we saw that there was an Australian news reporter on CNN, I guess, and she was just sort of saying, yeah, there's been an earthquake, and now we see this wave coming up, and hopefully it doesn't do any damage, and it seems to be inundating the farmlands. And it was weeks later that we started to see the actual videos from the ground. People who were inside of the cars that we were seeing get washed away. Crazy stuff. There was a dog that survived out at sea for 3 weeks. There was this cat that was on a tiny weed clump that was 4 stories up, and it managed to live throughout all of this. I'm saying these things because the real devastation and tragedy is immeasurable. What happened is just absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a full-scale Chernobyl-level nuclear meltdown that happened after that, and we can't forget about our friends over there and what a massive disruption of everything, of the economy. another strange thing that happened is that Sony PS3s, the Sony PlayStation Network, also got completely jacked by some hacking consortium and brought to its knees for almost a month. At first, that seems like whatever, it's a game console and people can't go on and frag each other. But really, it extends to all of the massively multiplayer online games like EverQuest and all of these other things. And then it becomes millions and millions and millions of dollars in lost revenue, not to mention losing huge face and confidence, where Sony really needed that to make its comeback because Sony's had so many tough years. So now there have been hearings in the Supreme Court and millions of credit card numbers may have been compromised. And it's just been a rough haul for Japan since we last were on the podcast. And anyways, we do have to keep all of them in our thoughts and prayers and not just forget about it as the news does a wipe onto the next top story, which could be any number of things. I was actually, of course, shocked by the amount of attention that the royal wedding got, but maybe you guys can explain to me why these things are so attention-worthy.
I didn't see one thing about it, and my sister was complaining, who cares about the royal wedding? And then I was in New York, and I turned on the TV, and it was all that, and so I turned it off. I mean, cool. Somebody's getting married.
Do you think that Lady Gaga had an influence on some of the wardrobe that was worn?
No, I think Cinderella and the stepsisters did.
So I'm not going to talk about the royal wedding anymore. I was just amazed at how that was getting as much attention as it was, even as Osama bin Laden was picked off.
And tornadoes were happening down south,
which are still going on, the floods and those tornadoes. That was the other thing. It's not like there was just a tornado or there was just an earthquake. In all of these cases, these things all piled on. There was the tornadoes and the floods and, you know, this just wave of devastation that happened in the U.S., it happened in Japan. I think on Saturday, this is Saturday the 21st that's coming up, it's supposed to be the rapture. So the world is supposed to end this Saturday. I wonder if
I've seen those billboards.
Yeah, I have. Some dude.
What do you guys think about that?
Truffle?
Oh, put it on me, why don't you?
Well, I'd like your opinion. I can give mine after.
Well, I think it's very interesting the number of times just in recent history where someone or an organization has singled out a date and time where the rapture is going to happen or the world's going to end. I think the one that probably everyone really has at the forefront of their mind is
the Mayan.
Yeah, 12/12/12, which I've seen it explained was, you know, that was just as far as their calendar could go because that's as far as they could represent, not because of any other reason.
I saw a comical thing where it was explained where the reason they didn't finish their calendar is because they all got killed and disappeared.
With the Mayan calendar thing, I always thought it was a matter of semantics because they said in 2012, time as we know it will end, which could also apply to time travel. It could apply to just finding a new way of calculating time. So I'm not too worried about that. I'm not that worried about Saturday either because I actually have to go to an art show, and I know that I will shoot that footage for my documentary.
Well, going to an art show is much akin to the end of the world anyway, so you're kind of already going to be suffering on Saturday. To bring it home to the point I was just going to make was only that probably the benefit of this Saturday's would-be occurrence that all of these other ones through time have lacked is the sheer media power and presence.
Yeah.
That, you know, between the billboards that are all over town and the radio interviews and internet presence, obviously, more people, I think, are going to be paying attention to this one particular occasion.
But it's just a meme. Others. It's just some guy who decided to go out and buy these billboards because he feels by virtue of his own calculations that this is what's going to happen. He's missed a whole bunch of other deadlines, too.
Exactly. Incidentally, he's published and gone on record before in the past. No, this was going to be the day, and those dates came and went.
And what blows my mind is that anybody even knows about this guy's concept. So, to what you're saying, it's amazing how far and wide this has spread,
right?
This idea.
Yeah.
because it really just comes from one kook.
But the most important thing about it, he's supposed to be Christian. These are Christian right. people. It clearly states, if you're a Christian in the Bible, that the rapture will come and you won't know the date and you won't know the time.
Right.
And here he is trying to claim that. So.
Because he's better than you.
He is better
than you. Well, nonetheless, there have been some really cataclysmic happenings in the world.
And it makes you kind of stop and think.
It makes you take pause. We're only a couple of states away from where people are just being permanently displaced. It's amazing. If we didn't have the news, we wouldn't even know it was going on.
I have my survival pack. Anyone?
Oh, yeah. We did have a little powwow after the Japan incident, where we got together and started figuring out, well, what would be our strategy if there really was the huge earthquake that's supposed to happen here, the San Andreas Fault? And what would it be like? And where would we go? And what would happen when the power went out and there was no Twitter and there was no Facebook and we had to survive and you couldn't get supplies in or out? It was an interesting little meeting. And I remember there was this huge upsurge of sales at this site called nukepills.com. Everybody suddenly wanted to put iodine in their system and make sure that their thyroids didn't get irradiated and they didn't get cancer. And I mean, it was a real panic that was going on.
And do you feel that that panic was a result of just the prevalent media coverage in Japan only, and that just like the way people went out of their minds trying to get Cipro right after 9/11 in case there was an anthrax attack, that all those iodine right. paddles or pills are just going to go unused what in medicine cabinets and thrown away 5 years from now?
Well, I sure hope that people didn't start popping them, because you could really do damage to yourself by taking these like iodine supplements.
Well, there was like countdowns of when the radiation was going to get here.
Yep. I remember keeping the windows closed for a couple of days just because I was worried that it was all going to fly through the windows.
It rained.
Nuclear rain.
Yeah, the day that the cloud hit us here in Los Angeles, it rained. And not only did it rain, it was the LA Marathon.
Yeah.
The next day. So you had people running for hours, 26 miles through radiated nuclear rain.
I heard the person that won grew an extra finger. Just kidding.
Okay, so that's the world as we record this. This is the recent events. And one of the things I've kind of meditated on while I was at the NAB show was, what is the value of this podcast? Because we tend to talk about the near future and about tech and everything else. And you would tend to think that this is all going to be obsolete shortly after. So why is this still relevant a year or two later, or even 3 weeks later? And I heard this guy talk about this university where they collect all the porn that's ever been shot. Did we talk about this ever before? So he was saying that there's this university in the US where they have this comprehensive archive, kind of like the Cinematheque of porn. And the reason for that is that porn, because of the way that it's shot, usually with available footage, you know, available locations and sets and costumes and whatever, is the ultimate document of a culture in the middle class at any given point. So you can understand what people were like and dressed like and lived like in the 70s better by watching a porn than almost any other thing, which would tend to veer into fiction. And by the same argument, I think of this podcast as that. In a way, by us discussing the near future, we're creating a relic. We're creating this sort of document of the past. And these details that may not last, these gadgets and gizmos and woozits and whatsits that matter to us now, many of them may be forgotten, but it creates this breadcrumb trail to how things got to what they will become, to what the iPad 6 is and to whatever else. So that was kind of, I guess, my way of encouraging myself to keep going, because we may not even remember much about the Japan quake in a couple of years, much like we don't talk about the Haiti quake much anymore, or the Chilean quake.
Or New Zealand or Mexico.
Exactly.
Or any things that have happened in the last
two years. At least for that, I hope it serves as a document.
What else did you find interesting at the NAB show?
So let's,
now that we're on that subject.
So let's talk about the NAB show, because again, we've always covered it. We've covered it on this podcast for almost 3 or 4 years. And one of the things that always recurred was the idea that 3D was going to be big. And of course, now it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's also a given that a film that's released in 3D will do more in sales at the theaters. The argument that there wasn't enough theaters and that the novelty was going to wear off no longer holds any water.
Although, to that end, there is a very interesting cultural timeline to look at regarding 3D, which is that every 30 years it crops back up. Exactly every three decades it crops back up. It was big in the 50s, post-war 50s.
Yeah.
It went out of fashion in the 80s. 30 years later, it made a brief comeback with Friday the 13th in 3D and Jaws 3 in 3D and Captain Neo and so forth. Then it went out of vogue again, and here we are in 2011, 30 years after that, and we're looking back at 3D like it's the greatest thing.
Yeah, but the thing that people need to understand about 3D, and this is something that you really get from going to NAB, is this year it was no longer the promise of 3D or the possibilities or imagining the future. It was a given. It was a de facto standard. And most of the seminars and lectures and super sessions about 3D weren't about what its promise was. They were about how to make it even better than it is and how to master it and how to sort of move deeper into the technology. It's a completely new technology. What we see these days as 3D is something that we've never, ever seen before. We've never been witness to the sorts of things that we're seeing on screens. There are different systems for how it's implemented. They are very advanced. One of the things that we saw was the keynote address with James Cameron and Vincent Pace, and they are forming a partner group that is going to be putting out a lot of 3D content. And James Cameron sort of said to all the TV broadcasters that were there, you know, you guys are next. You're pretty much where we're headed, and we're just waiting for you to get on side. But everything's ready to go at a fast clip. We were seeing all sorts of $5,000 cameras and under that are now just built-in 3D, shooting high def.
We also saw, which was kind of neat, a cell phone that actually showed 3D without glasses.
Well, actually, that wasn't even a cell phone. That was just an iPhone.
Yeah.
But we were in on a lecture with this guy who's been involved in studying the principles of three-dimensional recording and playback for almost 35 years. I mean, this guy's life has been dedicated to this. And he showed this method where if you took a picture of yourself or someone and a second picture shortly after, that's just a couple of inches away from the original, and then you were to play those two images back and forth at about 4.5 hertz, then the way that the brain basically interpolates the space in between those two keyframes convinces the mind that it's looking at a three-dimensional image. If it's faster or slower, the brain will figure it out. Much like with 24 frames. If you play something back at 24 frames, we figured out that's pretty much the speed at which we perceive something to be in motion, in smooth motion. And if it's any slower, it starts to appear stuttery to us. If it's much faster, it appears sort of hyper-real. So he was showing that he'd figured out just the right balance to be able to do this auto-stereoscopic imagery. Auto-stereoscopic, of course, means you don't need glasses. And what was more incredible was that he figured out how to do that intermittent left and right frame in motion. And so he demonstrated this crane shot moving down along a riverbed on an iPhone that looked three-dimensional without glasses. And that's where it's going. Basically, the way that the eye works is that it sees a very, very tiny little spot in focus. We think that we see everything in focus, but in fact, if you were to have like a globe, like a map of the Earth, all you would see is like Tijuana if you were looking at the entire world in focus. So what happens is your eye moves around, it races around, and it looks at points, and then it actually starts to draw lines in between those points until it creates kind of like a wireframe of whatever you're looking at, and your brain fills in the blanks. And that's how really it's supposed to work. So instead of having these two full-frame images squished together that look blurry playing at you the whole time, he's looking at it a very different way. And so even now, three-dimensional playback is discovering even better methods to deal with this kind of stuff. That kind of scenario actually allows each individual person to parse it according to how their eyes work and how their brain works. So it's much more effective than kind of sticking the same pair of glasses on everybody. You know, people who have prescriptions and may have an astigmatism in one eye or maybe colorblind or whatever, this would allow everybody to kind of parse things the way that they parse anything in reality. So it's a far more effective process. So that was one interesting thing about NAB, was just kind of seeing the evolution of three-dimensional science and how it's being implemented into entertainment and
how it's turned not into a fad, how it's become actually.
So help out everybody who's listening along, because I think that everyone's current experience, mine included with 3D, has been you go to the theater, you get even bigger, funkier glasses than you ever had before, and you kind of sit and you watch for an hour and things come at you, or they appear to be multidimensional, but at the same time everything still is a little flat and it's hyper real, but it's not realistic. Coming out of NAB, we're sitting here today on May 17th, 2011. Tell us what we're going to be looking at May 17th, 2012, heading into the big blockbuster summer movie season then.
I think that part of what you're missing is that old 70s experience of, I can't wait to see the part where the sword sticks out of the screen and wipes across everybody's heads. What they're much more interested in now is the depth behind the screen and creating a more natural gradient, as it were, between the foreground and the background, so that it doesn't feel like you're looking at multi-planes, but this much more natural-seeming universe.
They do a good example of that is when they film like golf or a lot of sports events that I was watching, just being on the golf course, and I'm not one to be watching golf, but I was fascinated because the depth of it, you can watch Tiger Woods do his shot and get a hole in one and just watch it go. And it feels
well, your like perception of the actual dynamics of the sport change. You get a much more in-depth view of really what's at stake for him when you see him swinging. The other interesting thing was, not only were we seeing Tiger Woods in three dimensions and the course and the ball and the swing and everything else, but they were also shooting him at like 200 frames per second. So you saw every ripple of his shirt as it went around, and this one quick stroke actually played back over the course of 4 minutes. It was just unbelievable to see the amount of muscle work and movement and refinement that was involved in what he was doing. So there's a lot of, I mean, then if you think of scientific application, even, you know, just to be able to look at an object, for whether it's surgical, whether it's whatever other procedure, whether it's a disaster area, and have a three-dimensional version of that. Because one of the things that's happening now with the technology is that it's real time. It's not like it has to be processed and everything else and then rendered out. It's three-dimensional on capture. So you're going to be seeing a lot of live 3D events. And that's going to give you a different ability to maneuver your way around the subject.
And that university, 3D porn.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, the first three-dimensional porn was actually released this year.
It was.
Yep.
I'd have to argue with you on that one, only because I was submitted to the whims of several female friends of mine years ago that made me accompany them to a theater to watch a three-dimensional porno movie that was shot in the late 70s or early 80s.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because I wonder if they made it three-dimensional after the fact, or if it was actually captured 3D with two cameras.
That I can't answer.
I guess the point that about this porn was that it was shot at the same level of advancement in the medium as
Avatar.
Well, that was the 3D part of NAB. And, you know, a lot of people said, what's the point of going to NAB? All they talk about is 3D. Well, there were some other buzzwords, and I'll just cover them really quick. I think this year's big buzzwords were cloud, telepresence, and transmedia. So cloud is something that everybody's pretty much probably familiar with by the time that they're listening to this podcast. Netflix streaming is cloud-based. Foursquare is cloud-based. Anything where you're pulling data from a bank of servers that are not locally hosted in your home is pulling it from the cloud. What's the difference between that and the internet? Well, whole businesses are renting, for example, server space, CPU processing, storage at Amazon, and then running their entire business remotely that way, as opposed to having server farms in their building or whatever. So the cloud is something that we're going to hear a lot more about in the years to come. Microsoft is super hardcore pushing on that action. It's just like making your computer a part of this giant matrix and not just being a local thing. But one of the scary things about the cloud is that Amazon, who does host, in fact, Netflix, and who does host Foursquare and a whole bunch of other really big companies, went down for a week at the end of April and disrupted all of these businesses. That's the scary part.
It is scary, and but better that it happened now as an example, them being the more or less the big business model harbinger for how this technology works, because the concept of cloud has been around for a long time now. It's certainly not new. It's only kind of coming into its own as broad-based and hands-on for everybody, particularly in business applications. But God forbid we got 10 years from where we are today before something like that happened. And you and I have joked, what happens when the EMP goes off or the nuclear bomb hits and there's an EMP as a result of that, and just all of that gets completely wiped out.
Yeah,
I think it wound up being a useful taste of how wonderful this technology is, but at the same time, how it can all be taken away very, very quickly, and how we need not be so awed by it that we forget the implications of relying too much.
Yeah, but also we can't be so afraid of it, you know, to say, oh, but now, you know, this is the new evil. I mean, every time a technology sort of trickles down into the mainstream, there are all of these doomsayers that say, oh my gosh, the world's going to change.
Well, I don't mean in those instances. I just mean we have to be careful in our reliance. Let's look at it this way. When we look around the globe and we look in our oceans and we look at different places on the planet, we know that there are ancient civilizations that were very advanced well before our common day appreciation of them. And yet there's no record of what happened and where they went. And, you know, who knows? There's all sorts of theories about, again, whether we were talking about the Mayans earlier, or was there not actually an Atlantis, or the lost cities that they found in the oceans off Japan and India and so forth. Theoretically, they could have used something for their written record just as precarious as a cloud application, and it could have all been wiped out just like so. So it's not that it's evil. It's just that we have to appreciate how powerful the technology is, and in that appreciation, come to terms with how it impacts our daily life and just make sure we don't invest fully in it. Otherwise, we might find ourselves going without in a very harsh way.
Right. You might want to keep one foot on the ground.
Correct.
Another interesting thing like the cloud is distributed computing, which has also been around for quite a while. Distributed computing is where you can donate your computer's processing power, storage space, memory, and everything else to solving some of the major, you know, problems in the world, finding clean water, finding a cure for cancer, looking for forms of intelligent life out there. There are dozens and dozens of initiatives to which you can donate your computer's processing power instead of it just being a screensaver. You may wonder why that's different than the cloud. Well, it's not really. The cloud, in the sense that they were talking about it at NAB, was in the commercial sense, in the sense where now it's going to have a cute little brand name and a mascot, and it's going to have a little ringtone and whatever else, and you and grandma and little Jimmy are all going to be able to do something together in the cloud that's different than what you were doing last year. This week, I started pushing Dropbox on everybody because, A, I get a free 250 megs every time someone signs up. But lest you think me as an Avon lady, what was really going on was...
Yeah, you got me to sign up.
Well, I got you to sign up, but the benefits have been instant. You know, rather than me having to figure out a way to email a 100 megabyte file, I can just drop it in a folder. I don't even have to tell you about it. The next time you go to your computer, you'll have a little notice that says, you know, there's a new file in your folder. And you can just open it whenever you feel like it. You can copy it, you can delete it, you can add another file. But it was amazing to me that people in that I do business with were still wary of this. Well, what are you talking about? I mean, what is it going to do? Is it going to put a virus on my thing? Is it going to done? Do I have to give away all my information? So that's a sign that this is new. That's a sign that even though everybody's online, this is still just being introduced into the marketplace in that sort of scale.
Yeah.
Speaking of things, as an aside, that are being introduced into the marketplace, Amy, wasn't there something about Costco you wanted to mention?
Oh, yeah. I heard the other day, it reminded me of Idiocracy. Costco is now selling wedding dresses, designer wedding dresses at Costco. And right next to that, the wedding dresses are wedding rings and engagement rings for sale. So it's...
Want to get married on a budget? Come down to Costco. We'll set you up.
You can get your SpaghettiOs, your beef jerky. And your
romance, 50% off.
We can definitely get all the liquor
lawn
for the
chairs.
Reception at yeah. Costco.
Well, that's just how it is. I mean, that, you know, it's a matter of economy, I guess. People want... it's, but I guess that's the whole thing about it that's weird that you're pointing out is that really a wedding is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So why are you going down to Costco to get it with a rebate when you
buy
it?
Is it a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity?
Well, I guess that's the point why Amy wanted to bring it up.
I just thought it was funny.
So here's two more buzzwords. Telepresence is when you are not where you are, and yet you are represented visually. So if you think of Star Wars, where Obi-Wan Kenobi or Princess Leia are these little holograms on the table, that's telepresence. And what it will mean now is that people will be doing, and we've seen some examples of this. I think Will.i.am showed up in one of these on CNN with Larry King or something. But basically, people will be doing an interview and they look like they're sitting across the table from each other, like full body representation of each other, but really one person's not there. The other, you know, they're sitting in front of a blue screen across the world. So we're going to see that, a lot more of that. Again, it's not just the fact that we saw some cool little booth where they were showing telepresence. It was everywhere. Everything was about telepresence.
Jewel actually did a concert from San Francisco, and it was broadcasted live at NAB.
So she appeared to be at NAB?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay, cool.
Doing her concert.
I was trying to figure out why you were so excited about that. I was like, why didn't you just watch a video of it?
I know.
It'd be interesting to
I
go
totally
back
and...
Do you guys remember Wild Palms?
Yeah.
I remember
David
when I
Lynch?
Was... Yeah, when I was a wee lad watching it at home and not understanding what it was. But Wild Palms was that TV series, I think maybe based on a book or story, whatever. But basically, the technology, the whole gist of Wild Palms was a world in which telepresence actually exists. And you can sit around at home and not only just watch a sitcom, but because of the technology, telepresence, be involved tangentially or otherwise in it, and what happens to the scope of our realities and our interaction in a world where that possibility exists.
Right. It's not, we're not talking about virtual reality here so much as the appearance that people are somewhere where they are not, in a way where the illusion is basically indistinguishable from what we generally perceive to be reality. You know, when we watch the news, even though it's all put together and packaged, we still assume that what we're looking at is what we're looking at, that that's reporting from the street, that that's raw footage. Telepresence would allow you to put anybody wherever you want, and it would be indistinguishable live, not in a recorded, after-the-fact, post-production CG way, but like as it happens. So there's some interesting things to consider about that. The final word that was big at NAB, and probably maybe the least interesting, but it's a word that's going to get used a lot and you're going to get bored of it, is transmedia. And transmedia is what we used to call multimedia. It's what we used to call a 360 company, you know, a 360 company being that you don't just make TV shows, but you make all of the toys and the branding and everything that goes with it, and you put on the Broadway musical version of it, and then you have the record that comes out of the soundtrack, and then you make a video game. That's a 360 company. Well, transmedia was on everybody's lips and minds because basically they said you can't just launch a TV series anymore. You have to have the alternative reality game of it. You have to have the board game of it, and you've got to have all sorts of social media that's involved. So every one of these broadcasters and companies and everything else was just spilling over into the person in the seat beside them to figure out a way to make all entertainment a transmedia experience.
I went and saw a talk about the success of shows like Glee, and they were talking about transmedia and how without social networking live tweeting while the show was happening. The fans thinking that they're a part of this process allowed it to spin off and become a reality series that's going to be coming out about Glee and having this camp of people and spin-offs and concerts and tours and stickers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they're very aware of this stuff. It doesn't. It's not that it's just happening organically. It feels like it is, but it's not these grassroots fan-based movements. It's probably a response to a lot of that and understanding how powerful that really was, but they're trying to make sure that they're a part of the revenue stream, that the fans aren't just out there making millions of dollars on their own. There was one cool example about the show Heroes, where these guys created a Facebook app, Who's Your Favorite Hero? And they were making like $100,000 a month or more, like millions of dollars a month, completely independent of the show and its copyright and its trademark, because they were just a fan group thing. So basically the makers of Heroes said, we want in on that action, so we've got to start paying attention to that.
Yeah, and so now these new shows are doing that.
I think not only that, but I think they also realized the importance of trying to bridge the gap between seasons and when they're in production and when they're not in production. We've seen for the last several years various shows that have done webisodes during their breaks in production just to keep some kind of fresh content out there, because what happens is people get snared by other shows. And there's only so much time in the day. There's only so much space on the DVR with which to watch your favorite shows. And as soon as something comes along and supplants, you start watching Dexter while Lost is not in production or whatever, then it's that much harder to come back to Lost after the fact. So I think it's that kind of two-prong mentality. One, there's money to be made. There's gold in them there hills. And also, the longer you're away, the harder it is to come back and fight for the attention of those fans that you might have had.
Okay, for the gearheads, what really got a lot of buzz at NAB this year were the three big digital HD cameras. That was the Red Epic camera. And if you don't know or think you care about this stuff, just realize that a lot of the major feature films that you're seeing these days are actually not shot on 35mm film. They're being shot on these Red cameras. So the Red Epic camera was a 5K sensor. It's the most advanced processor of its type in the world. It allows this camera to capture up to 120 frames per second at raw resolution. So this is not a compressed format. And Aeroflex, who's one of the oldest makers of cameras in the world, has the Alexa, which is the same thing. It's a 12-bit sensor. It's got 3.5K capture. And then there's a new kind of company that's making a lot of noise. It's called Iconoscope. That's spelled with a K and a K. And they have a thing called the Acam DLL. And this is another camera that shoots uncompressed RAW in full HD. It's got a native aspect ratio of 1.78. It's basically just a monstrously big sensor. And it looks like a negative that comes out of a film camera. But the prices are coming down more and more and more on these things. And people were just going crazy. They look so beautiful. There's always been this argument about, can anything ever look as good as film? Well, film is an analog medium. That means that there's an infinite amount of complexity to it. It does beautifully with gradients and the way that it does drop off of light and how it handles shadows and everything. But it's a very, very expensive thing to deal with. It's also very tricky to deal with. You know, you can't expose it to light, and it's expensive because you have to do a print and then an answer print and all of this other sort of thing. But these, one of the things you start to realize is this stuff that we're looking at now is kind of its own medium. It's not trying to be like film. It's starting to look like something completely different. The resolution is different. The sharpness is different. And the way that the pixels can be manipulated is very different. I saw a very interesting seminar where they were talking about the workflow of Avatar. And a lot of the times they would go over to James Cameron and say, well, how do you want us to do this? Or how are we supposed to do this? Or how do we train for that? He goes, I don't know. We're making this up as we go along. And my friend, Dan Liebenthal, who was an editor, said the same thing of Iron Man 2. He said that a lot of the times he, as an editor, was sitting on set editing it as they were shooting it, looking at it, and then changing the scenery as it was happening. It's all sort of happening at the same time now. There isn't this like workflow where you start at point A, move to point B and C. all the departments are working at the same time because there's just digital pixels that can be moved around. You're not waiting to process the film to get it back and whatever else. So as a slight segue to that, the last thing I'll say about NAB that was a really important thing was in discussing how you can move pixels around and the nature of light and color and all of that, there was the very first ever presentation by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, who bring you the Oscars every year. And they were saying there's a lot of people that are shooting now with solid-state lights. That's LED lights. And they're using them to replace the old tungsten lights that we know so well, like the light bulb in your house is a tungsten light. So these LEDs have been everywhere, and everybody loves them because they're much cooler temperature, but they look just like the old thing, and they're cheaper, and they last longer, and everything else. Well, what they were saying is that now that we've been using these lights for 1 or 2 years in professional productions, they've started to notice that there are wild variations in color and reproducibility in the dailies that they see after shooting. The problem is that when they're actually looking at this light with their light meters and everything else on capture, and when the naked eye is looking at it, everything seems to be fine. But once it's captured by machines that are just doing their job and do not have that kind of subjectivity and played back, they were seeing that there was huge discrepancies and changes from one day to the next, and they couldn't predict them. And they were saying, you know, there's no standard right now that exists for these non-tungsten lights. Why does this matter and why does anybody care? Well, because in 2014, tungsten bulbs, incandescent bulbs, are going to be essentially outlawed. They're going to no longer make them because they're energy hungry and they're not efficient in terms of that. And we will no longer have those traditional light bulbs that we know. If we get to that point in 2014, we stop manufacturing these things and start shutting down those factories, and yet we don't have a standard for how to capture and predict color and control that color temperature, then photography and film and everything will not be able to operate the way that it does now. Because tungsten lights have been around for 80 years, and everything that we've built, the kind of film stocks that we use, the lenses, the meters and everything else, even the color of paints that we use in our house is based on the assumption that it looks, it's in response to the reflection of that tungsten light. So with this new solid state light, we have to set up some standards. That to me was kind of eyebrow raising, especially when I turned around and I looked at this giant show floor that's like 8 football fields wide, and there's dozens of companies hawking these solid state lights going, yeah, ours is just like this natural tungsten color temperature, and yet they have no standard. So all of that gear that people are buying right now really may just be junk in a year or two. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
Oh, and we saw the FCC chairman, Julius Genachowski, do a breakfast talk where he was talking about bandwidth. You heard us speak on the last podcast about bandwidth, you know, how in Canada this company Rogers is setting caps on how much people can upload and download and starting metering your internet and saying it's like if you use over this amount of bandwidth in a month, it's going to cost you this much money. Well, he had his solution for what will happen when bandwidth starts running out. The reason the bandwidth is running out, ladies and gentlemen, is because we used to use it for email. But when suddenly everybody's watching their favorite TV shows.
Or watching puppies.
Watching puppies on Ustream in their kennel 24 hours a day. And we're not just watching it at low resolution. We're watching the stuff in HD. The magnitude of the demand increases tenfold, even a hundredfold. You know, they said that daytime is the new prime time because people are watching telenovelas on their Sprint phones at work. That's a lot of demand. So everybody was looking to the FCC to say, what are you going to do? How are you going to solve it? What is your solution on this? And he said, well, we've got this great idea. We don't have really time to figure it out in the big way. So our short-term solution is going to be we're going to auction off bandwidth to the highest bidders. That's kind of like saying that you'll let Coca-Cola buy one of the Great Lakes because that's what we need to keep things going, which is okay for a second, but it's not going to be good when suddenly there's nowhere to get water except from Coca-Cola, who can then jack the price wherever they want.
I hesitate to go back to my earlier statement about investing too much and relying too heavily on certain technologies. And here we find ourselves in the post-digital age relying greatly on bandwidth, and eventually it can only handle so much. It can only arrive in so many places in so many ways, and we find ourselves at a crossroads right now. And the crossroads is, what's more important? I think in the Western world, where consumerism is dominant, what the public is going to choose to be more important is watching TV shows and movies and puppies 24 hours a day on Ustream. And the impact that that kind of attitude is going to have globally remains to be seen. But we really need to stop and consider for just a second where we're heading with our bandwidth and what we're using it for. As of today, there's no existence of an emergency broadcast system or anything for bandwidth. In the event of another major catastrophe or whatever, what happens? And with people relying less and less on analog media, which that technology was harvested for emergency purposes, what's the next step? I mean, one day the servers go dead, and I hate to keep bringing it back to
it's
this.
It's a total blackout.
It's kind of the theme of the show. The theme of the show has been all these disasters that have been happening lately.
I get my news off the internet.
That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. We rely on our phones. We rely on our laptops. Wi-Fi, by the way, which I think is like the worst technology ever. We rely on Wi-Fi, and people are completely untethered. God forbid you walk into somebody's house and find an Ethernet cable. But what's the next step? I mean, where do we go from here? And what if there's a giant solar flare or something? Who knows?
And I guess that's the point that I'm making, is that there are these policymakers that are making these decisions that are going to affect absolutely everybody. This, some of the stuff I'm saying may sound pretty dry and boring and like, who cares right now? But this is really going to affect the way that things happen in the future.
Yeah.
And if you think that you don't care, just imagine turning off your power for 24 hours and seeing how well you do finding your friends.
Which is something that happened just a few years ago on the East Coast and in parts of the Midwest in the United States, when part of the power grid failed and people went without power for 2 and 3 days. And you say, okay, well, that just means my refrigerator is gone and I can't watch TV or whatever. But really, that affects everything from flushing your toilet, because the water plant, the pressure that comes from the water plant is powered by electricity, to streetlights in your neighborhood. There goes the safety, and so on. It's really more far-reaching. And if we rely on the internet, like Amy was just saying, for our news every day, what happens when we lose that technology? Well, then we don't have news. You got to go digging around for a radio. And if those bandwidths are knocked out of vogue and auctioned off by the FCC, which is exactly what they've been talking about doing, then we're going to lose access to that immediacy and the availability to talk to everybody at one time in the event that we lose electricity or bandwidth or both or whatever.
Well, look what happened in Iran last year when there was this uprising, and basically the Iranian government said, you know, we're going to just shut off all of the services, all the internet services. They still found a way, because they had to communicate that way. That was the only way to get information out. Look what's happening in Syria right now. There's just like hundreds and hundreds of people being killed in Syria, yet we have almost no reporters on the ground. I mean, when's the last time that you saw a news report from inside the battlegrounds in Syria? You just don't see them, and nobody can get in. It's just far too dangerous. No one's allowed in. So the only way that we hear about this stuff is via Twitter and Facebook. And if that goes away, so when you've got this guy saying, you know, we're going to give bandwidth away to the highest bidder, which will be Comcast and whoever else, those guys are going to control what you see and what you don't see.
Right.
They can just make that decision. And you know what? You will never even know it was taken away from you. You will not even know the difference.
Well, we'll never know, because we're too busy watching puppies in a kennel all day long.
Yeah.
And Hulu and Netflix streaming. And these are the kinds of things that are happening while we're entertaining ourselves on our brief 80-year stay on this planet.
One of the interesting things about being at NAB that makes it different from other trade shows is that the people that are sitting beside you at these conferences are not Comic-Con fans. They're broadcasters. These are people who are used to – they've built small broadcast companies that, you know, that do the local news in whatever town in the U.S. and have a broadcast tower. They're sitting there sweating it out. They don't know what's going to go down. They really have no better idea than I do sitting there what is going to happen next. And this news that's coming at them, coming at me and coming at them, is just, it's defining the future. Most of them are clueless. They really don't know what to do. They think that maybe they should set up a Twitter page.
I think that's great. I think that the things that we're talking about, all of these amazing innovations that have really happened in the last 15 years or so, have all happened simply because the old guard didn't know how to react, or reacted too slow, or didn't know or understand what the technologies were. And so they grew largely uninhibited, and also, this is a key point again in the Western world, largely unregulated. And if Canadian governments or the U.S. government could have regulated these earlier on and you know, made it to the point where manufactured obsolescence was built in even earlier in the process, I'm sure they would have.
A cool presentation that we also saw at the NAB show was the people behind Rango, which was a movie that not enough people saw. I think because there was sort of a backlash against Johnny Depp or whatever. But Rango was this really terrific CG film about a chameleon out in the Nevada desert, and he gets lost, and he is kind of a shyster, and nobody has water, and everybody's trying to find water, and he's lonely. But what was amazing about this is it was actually on a seminar called The New CG Film. And I thought, well, what's the difference between this and Rio or Shrek or whatever? The level of detail and texture and lighting in this film was like nothing I've ever seen before. And
it's incredible.
Yeah, I wondered why it looked so different until I realized that one of the people behind it is John Knoll. And John Knoll is an expert in lighting. He goes all the way back to Lucasfilm and LucasArts, but also is one of the inventors of Photoshop. And he was behind a lot of the technology used in Rango, which was also directed by Gore Verbinski, who did the whole Pirates of the Caribbean series.
I think one of the cool things about Rango is that when they, before they filmed it, they actually acted the scenes out.
Right, they actually all stood around and just acted it out, and that's what they used to animate it.
Yeah.
And one of the quirks about Rango was that because he's got those chameleon eyes, they were trying to figure out how to make him look, and they showed how in every single kid's CG movie that's ever been made, they always have those big Muppet half ping pong ball eyes. But with Rango, his whole eye is covered in flesh, and it comes down to this tiny little point that's an opening. And they said they weren't quite sure how that was going to play, but they decided that that way they could make the whole eye expressive because it had all these like layers of skin and whatever. And it does make a difference. It's sort of a much darker character. And all the characters in this are really dark. Like there's a rabbit that's got one ear that's ripped off, and there's a guy who's got an arrow that's permanently lodged in his skull. I mean, it was pretty dark matter. And they have like 40 or 50 characters in the film, whereas usually there's like a cast of 3 or 4 in the Disney style. So anyway, I recommend you go see Rango. We got to see some cool behind the scenes things about it, but it really was kind of a step forward in animation. And the coolest part about it too was that none of these guys that worked on it had ever made a CG movie before, and in fact had no idea how to make one. They just kind of said, let's just kind of do it and see where we get. So they were breaking all kinds of rules because they never knew what the rules were to begin with.
That was sort of what I was kind of getting at, speaking about the technology being able to grow unbridled. It's when you have guys who don't know what they're doing but have ambition and are willing to figure it out as they go, like you were saying earlier when they were on the set of Avatar and so forth. That's when true innovation takes place, and that's when those technologies are realized, because no two people use any technology in the same way. We don't, the three of us sitting in this room, don't use the internet for the same things. When you put people in an open sandbox and just let them rip, that's when the world becomes a better place. When you have stodgy guys in three-piece suits sitting behind their desks or in a federal courthouse making decisions for us, that's when the world remains mundane and continues to lack sparkle, and we're buying
the same. And it harms a lot of people.
Correct.
It can't possibly address everybody in that situation. Do you guys have any final things you want to talk about in terms of tech?
Tech. I just wanted to speak about Amazon. They announced a Kindle lending library. So later on this year, they're going to allow Kindle users to borrow books from about 11,000 libraries.
So what does that mean, borrow a book? It means that you can read the entire book for a period of a week or two?
An e-book. You can lend it, like, as if you were going to the library.
Because the Barnes & Noble Nook lets you lend a book. If you buy a book, you can lend it to another Nook. I wonder what the business model is there. I mean, I guess Amazon does great because they sell more Kindles, but how do the libraries or the owners of those books that are not out of copyright benefit?
I don't think they do. I think it's pure exposure for them on their part, and it's content on the part of Amazon and people who use Kindle, and that's kind of the mutual, that's kind of where the benefit.
But if I go to a library, I can borrow a book, and then I can go back to the library and just borrow it again until I'm finished the book. So when does the owner of that license ever make money?
The law, the copyright law in the States is life plus 50 years, and then after that, any work lapses into the public domain. So it's more of a common problem than you would experience or think is actually out there. But ultimately what happens is whether or not something's public domain and whether or not someone holds a license or not, there's still generally the cost of manufacturing, producing, distributing, and advertising for a brick and mortar book. And all those things have gone away when you're talking about ebooks. So essentially it's just providing somebody the ability to loan or read something that nobody would really be making any money on anyway, unless you're buying like the latest leather-bound edition of Moby Dick because it's going to look really nice on your bookshelf.
I'm excited to check it out once it comes out.
I think it's great for the end user. I love my Kindle.
I just got my Kindle and I love it. I sleep with it.
I actually take all of my homework assignments from school and I email them to my Kindle and I read all of my homework exclusively on my Kindle now. I can't even read out of a book. I'm taking a programming class. I'm studying C and Visual Basic at UCLA. And I bought the book for Visual Basic. The thing must weigh like 9 pounds. I will never bring that thing to school. I just pull out my Kindle. I've got 40 of those books on there. And it's awesome. I can annotate them. I can just read all my notes from them later on my email. It's such
so
a better
good.
Way to deal with literature.
Yeah.
I hate to say that because I know there's a lot of book purists who still don't want to give up the ghost on that. But let me tell you, man, those books that are sitting around my place right now are just dust collectors. I'm just going to say that one last
time.
They
smell good, though.
They smell awesome. Don't get me wrong.
They make you look quite erudite when I walk into your apartment. Before we go down to the studio to do this kind of stuff, I often look at those books and say, this is a man who has knowledge.
Yeah, they're definitely a pretty accessory.
I want to talk about this because this is fun. It came up the other night at dinner. Friendster is relaunching. They are deleting all past user content.
No.
They're leaving accounts in place, but any posts, any pictures, anything that you have are long gone, and I think the deadline for that has already come and gone. They're relaunching as primarily an Asian-centric site, and there's a reason for that, and that reason is part of their downfall originally, as it turns out. So there's going to be a brand new Friendster shortly, which is very interesting. Part of the reason it's going to be Asian-centric is because when Friendster was at its prime, over half of its users, over half of its traffic was coming from Southeast Asia. Primarily from the Filipino community. And one of the things that Friendster was doing was they had a lot of speed problems. The site was very slow at times, and they would take the site down for maintenance and so forth. One of the things they were doing was taking it down at night when they thought that people wasn't prime time and people weren't using the site. Turns out that half a world away over there in the Philippines, that those people were very, very active at that time. All of that is kind of interest as a footnote because, you know, who's not on Facebook at this point? Even MySpace is antiquated by comparison, except when you stop to appreciate the fact that Friendster holds the patent on social networks.
They do?
They were awarded it in 2006. And they haven't done much with it since. It's very interesting because while Friendster is getting ready to relaunch, the talk about the Facebook IPO has come to the point where it looks like something might actually happen this year. If you were Friendster and you got waylaid by MySpace and then Facebook and you held the patent on social networking, wouldn't you want to wait to do any kind of filing a lawsuit until the biggest social network on the planet went active, became a public company, had an IPO, and was worth real, actual billions and billions of dollars?
Wow, so Friendster can come over to Facebook and say, by the way, you owe us for using our idea.
Well, ultimately, it'll be for the courts to sort out if it comes to that. But yes, they do, for the last 5 years, have held the patent on what a social network is. And what's interesting about that, when you consider what happens when guys in suits, when Wall Street guys take over companies that deal with emerging technology, is when you look at a company like Friendster, which is kind of the punchline to any joke about social networks. Friendster, by and large, was considered a failure. It was the first through the door, but the last to really benefit from the broadening of the internet and the appeal of social networking, which they devised. And part of the reason for that failure was they did what they thought they were supposed to do. They followed the business playbook, which said, when you have a product that people want, when you have interest, you bring in the big guns, you bring in some Wall Street guys, you get some VC money, and then you go big. You go for the touchdown. And what happened was they brought in some guys, some CEOs and guys to take over their board that were completely out of touch with the technology, didn't understand what a social network was, didn't know what to do with it, and just tried to put a by-the-numbers business plan in place. And this is why when we talk about a film called The Social Network, we're talking about Facebook and not Friendster. So the benefit, and forget about the internet for a second, just any technology, the benefit to any technology is when you have guys who live in a vacuum or guys who are considered the fool on the hill doing what they instinctively think is right and working in their world and just kind of flying by the seat of their pants and what's in their gut. And that's why you end up with a book like Outliers, a complete book talking about nothing other than these guys who innovate over on the fringes, and they don't pay attention to what's going on in Wall Street. As soon as you bring in big business, as soon as you bring in government regulation, is when you lose touch with what's going on in your gut, and everything gets compartmentalized and broken down and put into nice boxes, and suddenly there's a rule book by what you think you're supposed to play. And when you have that rule book, you're not thinking about anything else. You're just focusing on what's in front of you.
I may have to end this show with my song I wrote way back in the day called Friendster. It's this perfect little document of what I felt like at the time, bemoaning the loss of my real life social networks for this new digital thing that was happening, how I wasn't seeing anybody anymore, and I was just sitting at home and talking to them on Friendster. So it's a great little document of what that actually felt like at the time. I would never be able to write it now, because I don't even remember that feeling now of loss. It's interesting to see that come full circle.
Right.
A nice little whammy you brought in there at the end. Truffle.
Let's do a couple of quick user questions. We got a letter from John Mooter, and he says that there are problems with our episode number 6, which is basically about macrobiotics and raw food diets. He says that macrobiotics recommends 60 to 50% whole grains and not 70%. It is by weight, not volume. A typical meal would be a plate mostly of greens and vegetables, which are lighter. He says it was a great discussion. He believes that neither all raw or all macro is necessarily best for everybody, but something in between that combines the best of both. He says some raw food is very extreme, like David Wolf eats smashed ants and deer placenta.
Yum.
And some macros smoke cigarettes, and he tries to take what is good from both. When you say you try to take the what is good from both, John, do you mean cigarettes and deer placenta? I'm not quite sure what the balance is there. But I think it's a good point that you raise. I'm certainly not a stickler for, you know, if I said 70% or 60%, the best thing I ever got from macrobioticism was understanding to be aware of a balance at all, to understand that there is kind of a relationship between one thing and another. It's not just add some greens to the side or hate salad, but it's actually a matter of ratios and sort of saying, if you have a lot of salt, then you can counter it by doing this kind of thing. Don't have a lot of salt, so you don't counter it by having a lot of sugar after or a lot of water or whatever. So you can understand that these things have a give and a take and a push and a pull. That was the best thing that macrobioticism taught me. I don't think that a raw diet is up for me to talk about whether it's good for you or bad for you, except that, as I mentioned in that episode, I believe, the problem I have with a raw diet is that well, the thing I liked about macrobioticism is that everything tends to be lightly steamed, which breaks down the cellular wall and allows you to get to the nutrients far more quickly and so get a much better return on your investment. It makes you less tired as a result. It makes you feel less fatigued and achy, and it's why sometimes raw people tend to be a little sickly. For all of the bright glow of the raw food that they're eating, they tend to have slightly more problems with immune system, I find. And I don't want to get too crazy about this because it can become quite political, but that's my take on macrobioticism. So thank you for pointing out that it is not as many whole grains as I have pointed out, and I do appreciate you writing into the podcast. I also got a question from Tanya Sobchuk, who's in Sudbury, Ontario, and she said, what do I think is going to happen now that the Canadian progressive conservatives have a majority government? Well, given that we have listeners all around the world, I'm not sure if everybody will understand or not understand or care about the implications of this, because it's generally a tepid affair, except for the fact that the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, has had more than questionable tactics for staying in power, and has some rather frightening policies to put into play. I don't really want to opine on this, but I do feel like that Canada is in a really sort of darker time than it's been for quite a while. And I'm worried for what was really quite a beautiful experiment taking a turn for the worse. But, you know, there were a lot of voters for Stephen Harper, and I respect their vote, and they may know things that I don't know. So I really can't say, and I'm not a crystal ball. Anything I might say beyond that would be partisan, so I'm going to leave it at that. And thank you also for writing. We have a new Facebook page. You can now find the Karamcast on Facebook. So just look, do a search for karamcast.com, spelled KeramCast.com. And we're on Twitter at Karamcast. And Amy Lynn Chadwick is on Twitter at
Amy L. Chadwick, A-I-M-E-E.
That's right. And you can follow me on Twitter at K. Malitsky Sanchez.
Truffs.
Truffs, are you on the Twitter?
No.
You're such a samurai. Thank you.
Because if I was on Twitter, when it all goes dark, I'd be screwed.
You'd be screwed.
Yeah.
I want to thank you guys very much for joining me. This was a very information-heavy episode.
It was a lot to chew.
But I did promise a lot of my friends that I would report back to them from NAB because they couldn't be there. And hopefully this will serve as a good document and help out. I think on the next one we'll do an episode about clowns.
Clowns.
Clowns are scary.
Clowns and foosball.
I discovered
clowns, foosball, and hot dogs.
I discovered a site the other day.
Yeah.
But it was one of the most frightening clown sites I'd ever seen.
Ooh, I'm
going
to mail
life.
That to my cousin.
I've never had a fear of clowns. Everybody around me has a fear of clowns. What's the name for that?
I don't either.
Clownophobia.
Oh. Hot dogs.
Yeah, I want to talk about the amazing restaurants and foods that we have in this city.
Yeah, let's do a podcast all about yummy and weird and unusual food. You want to do that?
Sure.
I get a lot of questions from foodie friends that want to hear about that topic, so.
Yeah, because we're always on a food adventure.
Yeah.
We are definitely not the kind of people who go back to our favorite restaurant every day. We never go out to the same place twice, nope. For sure. In fact, I just want to give a teaser. Today we found this place called Chili Addiction. Which had the best hot dogs they were like jalapeno hot dogs that they make in the place with 100% pure ingredients. And like there's no additives, there's nothing extra, no mix.
They make everything down
to the
ketchup.
And they had jalapeno relish and habanero aioli that they put on this thing. And it was killer.
And they have the best chili and homemade ice creams.
They had violet ice cream and bacon ice cream.
Bacon maple.
I can sound off on this place is great.
Yeah.
It's on La Cienega in Los Angeles.
So thank you so much for listening to the podcast. We really do love having you write back to us. You can always do that too at info@karamcast.com. And we will see you next time with a discussion maybe on food and clowns.
Love it.
And Friendster and its takeover of Facebook.
Peace out.
Here's the song Friendster.
Willkommen, Damen und Herren, Madame et Messieurs. Do you feel good? Yeah!
In here, life is beautiful. The girls are beautiful. Even the orchestra is beautiful. Who's here because they saw my bulletin on Friendster? Raise your hand. Come on, there's more. All right, so this is for you guys. And whoever doesn't know what I'm talking about, whenever I say Friendster, look around and like pretend like you're in the know. Just be like, I don't want to fucking... Wrote a song about it. It goes a little bit like this. One, two, three. Dear Ian, I made a plan to leave the world behind. I don't watch TV or listen to clear channel radio. When we first met, they made a bet that we'd never survive. But somehow after 3 months, we were still going in strides. And then one night by pixel light, you opened up to answer an email invite asking to confirm you were a Friendster. Jacqueline quoted Suzanne by Mr. Leonard Cohen, and add to that a reading list that included the following: Anais, Nin, Kurt Vonnegut, Nick Cave, and Noam Chomsky. And was it fair that they could pair up two such perfect minds? With beating heart, I hit reply because I had to chance her. And so it was I lost my soul to some strange chick on Friendster. Doesn't mean if I can't remember my high life before Friendster. But my friend Sam, she's got a plan to take over the server. She's got enough confirms and testimonials for it to work. Now I'm getting all the spam that I could ever swallow. What happened to those nights we shared where there was no tomorrow? I guess she's set to hook a brother up with Aphrodite. But somehow that means finding a profile that can deliver. The catalog's been lots of fun, but I can still remember the day we lost the Silver Lake girls to that thing called Friendster. What does it mean if I can't remember my high life before Friendster? Listen, I used to go down to find my new friends at Cherimoya. The bourgeois pig was always filled with all the girls and boys. But lately it's been quiet by the old celebrity center. I guess because the Beachwood girls have all logged into Friendster. It would be wise to realize that nothing lasts forever. Where's Rubik's Cube and Atari and the solid gold dancer? True friends, they say, are those you know who will love you forever. Got 400,000 new ones I met on Friendster. 400,000! What does it mean if I can't remember my high life before Friendster? I say, what does it mean if I can't remember my high friends before Friendster? Shit!